ॐ ज्ञान स्मरण तस्य ज्ञानं जन शलाकय तत्सुरुन्द्रसंज्ञेन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोविष्टम् स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपाकदामायम् ददाति सापदन्तिकम् पञ्चाकल्पासुरुभ्यश्च पिपाशुन्दुभयेव च पतितानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्णा चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैत गदाधर शिवासदि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 रामो हरे रामो राम राम हरे हरे So greetings from the Sun Falls. I'm up at my place. It's actually, I don't know if there's other places, actually some snow on the ground. Usually I teach a particular text. I haven't gravitated towards that yet. I'm following a little bit different format. And what I'm doing is I'm let's see how far we can go with this, is I'm just sharing with Sangha various things that I'm preparing and studying. Right now, up here in Hudson, which is 20 minutes away at Sadhana Yoga, every other week I'm doing a Bhagavad Gita course. And it's a little bit of a challenge because, I've taught the Bhagavad Gita in Vrindavan for 10 years, where we have 18 chapters, 18 weeks. That means I would get 5 classes a week to cover a chapter, an hour and a half, 2 hour classes. Since I really want to get it down to the essence, and it's a challenge. I read something by Ernest Hemingway. He wrote a letter that was long, and he said, I'm sorry it's so long, but I didn't have enough time to write it. And I think it's like that, and why I like to teach and reteach and reteach the same things, or when I give classes, to summarize, because as you teach things, your frame of reference of the subject increases, and you know it a little bit deeply, and it gives you the facility to present it in a more succinct way. So I'm going to do something with the Gita. And I also gave a lecture on yoga forgiveness in New York City. Had some new insights on the subject. So let me just give a little short synopsis again. And what I tried to bring out in the first class, which is really a summary of chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita, is how the story of Bhagavad Gita sets up an archetypal dilemma that everyone faces. The form of Arjuna's dilemma, I think the substance of the dilemma applies to us. Of course, the form of his dilemma is a little bit different, but as you know, the Bhagavad Gita is just one part of the Mahabharata, which is this incredible story of the history of ancient India. One second, I have to do something here. So it's an the form basically, which builds up throughout this incredible text, is a fratricidal war. And the Bhagavad Gita is the part of that whole history where it brings it to the culmination, where the Pandavas, led, or we can say led by Arjuna, and his cousin brothers, the Kauravas, are now in battle. And because they were kings and nearly emperors, the world had to choose sides. So they're facing each other, and then Arjuna sees that who he's facing is relatives, and his people chose sides. It wasn't just the evil-minded Duryodhana who tortured his family, tried to defile his wife several times, tried to plunder and cheated and attempted to genocide, so many things, this other evil-minded Duryodhana. But other people had to choose sides, and for different social and political reasons, on the other side was some of the people that were closest to Arjuna, including his guru, his teacher, his military teacher, and he was a warrior, so that's everything for him, and his beloved grandfather. And there were 18 Akshalinis, these are particular military divisions, and each one was led by someone who had some very close relationship to Arjuna. And then he's there having to defend his family and having to defend innocent people, which is his duty because he's a Kshatriya. Kshat means herd, Triyate means to protect. His duty in society is a class of people that protect innocent people from aggression. So that's his duty. But the aggressors happen to be people that are near to him. So it sets up a crisis. So I look at the crisis on two platforms. One is an obvious moral dilemma. You know, Bhagavad Gita says, honor thy mother and father. Thou shalt not kill. Right, and now here he has to actually fight with his relatives and practically his parents. I mean, his grandfather is so close to him. And war means killing. One time, you know, when I was a very, very, I wasn't even joined the temple, and there was such a youthful energy and youthful passion, not quite Lord of the Flies, but, you know, such young people all of a sudden. The oldest people in the movement were 27. So when the elders are in their late 20s and don't necessarily come from a very profound cultural background, but were mostly, you know, maybe good families, but then became hippies, whatever it is. You know, there's a youthful exuberance and mistake. You tend to not be balanced. There's actually one, I read it somewhere, I don't know where it applied, but it said, all evil is absolute truth made relative, or relative truth made absolute. There's various truths that you experience that are contextual, but if you extend them too far, they wreak havoc, and we see that every place. So there was that youthful exuberance, and I walk into this one temple, and there's one real passionate monk, and he was saying, the Bhagavad Gita is such an exalted text. He said that, the Bible says, thou shalt not kill, honor your mother and father. And the first thing Krishna is telling to Arjuna is kill your family. You know, it was a lot. But actually, this is the dilemma he's in. So there's a moral dilemma. A moral dilemma. In other words, what is my duty? What is Dharma? And actually speaking, I mean, we're always in a moral dilemma in one sense or another. There's always so many subtleties. And our duties are also based on who we are, both eternally, spiritually, and materially. We have certain duties according to our temporary situation. Being family members, it's not an eternal situation. Being of a particular relationship, it's not temporary. You know, you're a son, and then your mother, your parents died. You know, your relationships are based on your family and everything. So there's a question always. We're always coming in, we're always faced with a myriad of situations. What is the correct choice? Sometimes it's very, very obvious, and many times it's not, because sometimes there's conflicting responsibilities, conflicting duties, subtleties, application of principles. So one simple definition of dharma or duty is the correct decision. And in spiritual traditions, a lot of the text is guidelines and situations that give you the tools to make the appropriate decision. And the appropriate decision is the decision which will also ultimately elevate your consciousness, which in a spiritual tradition is the ultimate goal, which is called enlightenment. So every decision you make is connected to enlightenment. This is an appropriate one and an inappropriate one. And the appropriate one is the decision. Or sometimes it doesn't matter which one you choose. So let's say they're both appropriate, just which is a little bit better. But they're appropriate and inappropriate. And the appropriate decisions, or the appropriate decision, is the one that is ascertained according to the tradition to be the decision that will elevate your consciousness. And it's different. Sometimes it calls for giving up something, renouncing something, and in another circumstance or another particular person, it calls for keeping that particular, even an attachment. It's not dharma, it's not your duty to give up an attachment if those attachments are too strong and need to be purified by working through them. So that one side is a moral dilemma. What is my duty? Which is archetypal. That's why we go to mentors. That's why we have teachers. That's why they're exemplars. We want to make the decisions that will elevate us in consciousness. And when consciousness is elevated, then perception and contentment are elevated. You see things better when your consciousness is purified, and you're also more happy, and you're also closer to the soul. When I gave the lecture on the yoga of forgiveness, and I was talking about why forgiveness in the appropriate situation, I've mainly talked about forgiveness as dharma. In a particular situation, you know, and in fact, most situations, you know, in interpersonal dealings and offenses are committed, you know, I mean, there's the appropriate decision, and if the conditions are appropriate, then the appropriate decision is forgiveness. Why? It's a moral duty. It's dharma. It's the decision that will purify the consciousness the most. And I discuss very, very strongly that in terms of yoga, and yoga means to purify the mind, the mind is an instrument. Yoga is the means to purify the mind, to bring the instrument of the mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. So, enmity is an action that degrades the mind and therefore brings it away from yoga. There's one quote that I gave, that the shadow of resentment keeps our spiritual light from shining through, never allowing us to fully experience who we are. If one is filled with hate, and whether there is justification or not, then it's going to skew, it's going to cover, it's going to distort the instrument of the mind to a lower level of perception and contentment. So, the first thing that the Bhagavad Gita sets up is a very, very difficult moral dilemma, determining what is duty, what is the right course of action. And the other, I think, archetypal situation the Bhagavad Gita sets up is an existential dilemma. Or put it this way, when you're in a situation where you have no alternatives, or whichever way you turn is a choice that is against your desires and attachments, then it's intense suffering. It's intense suffering. And what is suffering itself? Suffering is when the world moves against our desires. And the world will move against our desires because we're not the controller of the world. I'm just studying right now a book called Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Very interesting book. And the premise of the book, he's a psychologist, probably somewhere connected to Freud, but not exactly. He doesn't agree with him. But he presents that actually, if you look at it, what most of the problems in the world is people do not face their own mortality. They don't face the temporality of their material situation. They don't face death. And therefore, most of the aggression in the world, most of the actions that we do, is to deny it by creating something that we feel will last beyond the body, a reputation or an achievement or you know, something. And it's pushing us, but it's constitutional. If one is identifying, if one consciousness, if one's not self-aware and one's consciousness is reflected on the body, I say that then one suffers the illusion of non-existence. I think the second issue that's been brought up here is how to deal with suffering. The world is suffering. It's just sometimes, and the thing is, and the constitution of the world is, and we all know this, that a ounce of pain is felt more than a ton of happiness. So the world is suffering, and when it becomes overwhelming, it reveals it. It reveals it. It's suffering because we're not in control of it. We're not in control of it. So if our life plan for happiness is simply trying to control the world, to make the world conform to our desires, then we'll be frustrated. So when suffering becomes intense and there are no options, it becomes revealed. There are no options because as sure as death. But when it becomes revealed by calamity, when the world is in a karmic relationship with us at a particular time where it's rapidly moving against our comforts and desires, then it can inspire us enough to want to rise above that by seeking the eternal situation, by seeking the nature of the self, which is eternal, which is called self-realization. So I dealt with the chapter in that way. First, the role of suffering is not necessarily a bad thing. Suffering is a symptom of something bad. And the symptom is that we're moving against nature. And therefore we're suffering because we're going against our nature. And that's suffering itself. But the pain that arises from it is the indication. I give an example. You can put your hand on a hot stove. There's something seriously wrong that could seriously injure you. The hand is not meant for that degree of heat. It's unnatural for its capacity. But if there's no pain, then you won't make the proper solution, and the suffering ultimately will get worse. So when there are difficulties in the world for an intelligent person, who's a thoughtful, intensive person, then he sees there's some disharmony, and therefore he tries to get to the root of it. What's the ultimate cause of the suffering? And ultimately, he has to see, what is my dharma? What is my duty? On every level, he has to see, what am I doing against nature? It may start on the gross physical level. I'm feeling ill. Well, what am I doing wrong? I'm not exercising enough. I'm taking too much sugar. My body is not meant for this. I need more. At the mental thing, well, I'm not engaged in my mind has a particular psychophysical nature. I require this type of satisfaction and enjoyment in life. I'm not getting it, therefore I'm suffering. And then it can go all the way down to the soul. And the ultimate cause of suffering is the soul. The nature of the soul is to serve and love God. And God means what? It means the universal interest. It means that the love should be, the devotion and service should be in the broadest context. And that because we are souls, then if our life is not congruent with the nature of the soul, to serve and to love, then there will be suffering. And if the object of our love is not eternal, there will also be suffering. because there will be duality, that what we are attached to is temporary. One time I came to a class by a famous scholar, A.G. Mohan. I believe he was one of the foremost disciples of Krishnamacharya. And he's a great scholar. And at the beginning of the class, he really helped the people understand what the objective of the class is. And he said, I'm going to ask three questions. If you answer yes on all three questions, then there's nothing you need to learn. So the first question is, have you found what you are looking for? And the second question, and some people may. A lot of times we're seeking some intimacy, some relationship. And okay, so the second question then is it eternal? Because if you find what you're looking for, but it's not eternal, then you will not ultimately be satisfied. In fact, there'll be an equal amount of distress and pleasure in your relationship with that object. But you may have found God or yoga. So the third question was, are you always dwelling in it? Are you always focused in it? Because you may have found what you're looking for, it may be eternal. But if you don't have the spiritual discipline or the spiritual attraction to dwell in it, then you also will not be successful. So spiritual life, self-realization, is meant to first help you understand the nature of the self and then teach you how to live on that platform. The nature of the self, to find out what is the self. Because if you don't know who you are, you will not know what you should be doing. And if you're acting against your duty or dharma, then you will suffer. So this is Arjuna's, it also brings him to that. There's a moral, they're connected, because there's a moral dilemma. What's the moral dilemma? What is my duty? And you have various duties. So he has duties, and we do have duties in the world. There are duties in relationship to family. There's duties in relationship to government, to citizenship. There's different responsibilities, but they are our dharma or duty for the purpose of bringing us closer to the self. But that's the ultimate duty. So Bhagavad Gita says, when there is a conflict, then which duty takes precedence? It's the nature of the self, the nature of self to serve selflessly in a universal way. So the moral dilemma, what should I do, is based on what is duty. And if you don't understand who you are, and therefore don't understand what is your duty, then there can be no question of happiness. Because you will be acting against the nature of the soul. So that issue is dealt with. What is Dharma? And then also, what are the obstacles? And the obstacles are, because if first they're suffering, so you're trying to find out, okay, what is the cause? How have I acted against nature? Okay, then you may find out, okay, this is who I am and this is my duty. So now I've discovered it. But then it still takes determination. It's like in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, Arjuna is so bewildered that he looks at Krishna and he says to Krishna that to control the mind is more difficult than controlling the raging wind. How can I control my mind? And then Krishna says, it is possible. It is possible. But by practice and some detachment, there's obstacles. Anyway, so I was trying to glean the essential points. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting is, because ultimately it comes to a point that one needs guidance. When strong attachments arise, or when a desire arises for spiritual path, there's also a dark side that impels one against Dharma. There's different attachments. This is the right thing to do. But either I have an attachment not to do it because I'm conditioned not to, or I have another attachment that's an obstacle to it. So whenever that desire arises to spiritual life, then there's a dark side that impels one against Dharma. In the Bhagavatam, it's described 5,000 years ago. It's also connected to the same stories. The sages were seeing the coming of the dark age, and they would trikala gyan. They can look into the future, and when they're looking into the future, they're seeing that it's surcharged to opposition to spiritual life. So they say, "Pein alpa yashashu." Other people are short-lived. "Pein alpa yashashu kulav asmin yuge manda." That people are just naturally lethargic towards spiritual things. And even if they're not lethargic, and it says munda sumunda, it says they're unfortunate. People are unfortunate. They don't have an attraction. They don't have an understanding. But even if they do have an understanding, then they can be cheated. You see, in the modern world, it's so easy to pose as a teacher. So easy to pose as a teacher, especially in yoga. So it's also nice in the Bhagavad Gita, in this dialogue, too. I think one of the key points is it can't be overcome without guidance. So we actually see also in Arjuna his strengths and his weaknesses. His weakness, he's sentimental. He gets overcome by sentiment. There's an appropriate response, which is it's from his booty or his intelligence. It's simple. I mean, he's a warrior. He has to protect again, but he has some sentiments that are nice. And it's a compassion. There's a soft-heartedness, but it's not guided by the proper understanding. And therefore, there's also some egotism. But his strength is he's so sincere. He wants the truth, and he's willing to accept instructions, but also thoughtful. He's not a blind follower. He's willing to surrender with intelligence, but he's not willing to surrender his intelligence. Doubting is one of the five symptoms of intelligence. And in a spiritual relationship with a teacher, although one accepts that teacher's authority, and there should be a long period of examination, but one finds one who's actually expert in spiritual topics, then one should be thoughtful. And to elicit clear meaning, you don't surrender your intelligence, you surrender with your intelligence. And if some instruction or teaching does not coincide with your understanding or sensitivities or morality, you may not conclude, oh, the teacher doesn't know, but you say, no, I haven't understood properly. My frame of reference may not be sufficiently developed, and you elicit. So Arjuna, it had to be expressed. So he was thoughtful. And he was also very pious and compassionate. He felt dejected about the others, even though they did so many things to harm him. So he also had a certain piety. And he was bold. That he was willing, if you see Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, he was willing to accept reality, even if it went against his own attachments and conceptions. And there is a correlation between our attachments and conceptions. Because the principle in the world is that we want to enjoy. And some things we want to enjoy are not healthy. But enjoyment also entails being, it's not only just to fully enjoy, you not only need a sensual or ego gratification, we need a sense that it's the correct thing to do. There's so many things that we want to enjoy, but we don't feel they're proper, and therefore we can't. Or what generally happens is that the intelligence somehow serves our desires in the process of rationalization. It tries to justify what we want to do, not what's right to do. So Arjuna actually, you see in the Bhagavad Gita, there was naturally this process of rationalization too. But when he went through the process and had his doubts cleared, he was bold. He was willing to accept reality, even if it was against his ideas and attachments. And then we see Krishna's qualities. He did not impose his authority on Arjuna. He didn't want blind followers. And therefore, he allowed Arjuna this dialectic, where Arjuna said, I don't understand. How can this be possible? And he went through that with Arjuna. And that is the responsibility of the teacher. Because a lot of truths that will be beneficial for us, we don't yet have the frame of reference to comprehend. And therefore, by eliciting our doubts and raising questions, the teacher is able to see what in our frame of reference doesn't allow us to understand this truth, and therefore the teacher will explain again. And a lot of times it takes a very, very long dialectic, a very, very long dialectic, because we have so many misconceptions. is so many things we accept as truth that are not truth. And therefore, certain when we're trying to understand certain instructions, we don't have a proper frame of reference to understand it. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is being asked to fight. And he had the misconception, and most people have this misconception, that spiritual life means renunciation. It means to give up certain activities. Of course, certain activities may have to be given up. But activities in general don't have to be given up. The consciousness in which they are done has to be changed. So when Krishna kept on explaining to Arjuna the concept of buddhi or intelligence, Krishna was explaining buddhi in relationship to activity, that people are in the world, they have a certain nature, they have certain proclivities. And the best way for them to become purified is to act in the world, but act with a certain understanding and a certain discipline and a certain intelligence. So Arjuna just couldn't grasp this. It went on for 3 or 4 chapters. He could not grasp how work can be spiritual. We may have those misconceptions that we see someone who is a sadhu and sitting in the forest and automatically we assume he's spiritual because he gave up the world, but where is his mind? He may be doing that to gain followers, to gain respect. And then there may be a person that's in the world. He may have a briefcase. He may have a suit, a tie. But he's completely detached. He's just working in a way and giving the fruits of his labor to charity and to help people. So it's not the... So it was, he couldn't understand. So there was dialectic. So Arjuna did not want blind followers. He wanted Arjuna to have so he was a good teacher. But at the same time, as a good teacher, he made Arjuna face his attachments. When Krishna saw that this was the obstacle or this was the attachment that prevented Arjuna from going to the next step in spiritual life, he forced him to confront it. And what is an obstacle? Obstacle is the space between where we're at now in spiritual life and the next step that we need to take. And we can't take that step. Why are we not at the next step? Because between where we are at and between the next step, there's an obstacle. There's a particular attachment. There's a particular anartha. Artha means value. There's something that has no value to the progress of our spiritual endeavors, but we have attachment to it. Spiritual life is very, very, very practical and very, very beautiful to apply. It's not about renunciation. And where a person is situated, there's a way to progress with the proper guidance. But you have to face the obstacle between where you're at now and where's your next step. You may have 1,000 steps to make. You may have 100,000 steps to make. And every time you get to the next step, there will be something between you and the following one, the obstacle. Anyway, that's about what I can say today on this. Would anybody like to ask any questions? Anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Brother Raja Devadasi.
Thank you. Okay, I got the letter about the program that will happen at the end of April. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you leave those things with Gopi, sure. Anybody else like to say hello? Sometimes it's difficulty unmuting the phone. I think it's star six. Anybody else?
Hello again, Maharaj.
Thank you, Gail. Thank you.
Hi, I didn't get to check in the beginning. It's Bianca.
Bianca, thank you so much. I saw so many of your friends, Bianca, at my lecture on Sunday. Robin came.
Oh, wow.
Lisa Spinelli and Alex were there. So, there they
are. Wonderful.
Perhaps you'll come next week? You're not sure.
I'm going to try, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But I have to stay the night because it's 3 hours away.
No, there's no problem. We have some place that you can stay.
Awesome.
If you spoke to Tara, if you can come, I told Tara also, and she said it was very nice. She's a very saintly lady that just lives next door. She's also a Krishna Bhakta.
Yes.
And you know, she has a house with extra rooms. Tara loved it. We can speak to her. Okay, if you can, we'll
okay.
Very happy to see you. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. Anyway, I'll continue this format, and if I feel I need to do a particular text, I'll do that too. Thank you.